Hello and welcome to Shame Spiral. I'm Ellie Kremendahl, a psychotherapist turned comedian, and this is the podcast where I low-key exploit my therapy skills to interview guests about all things shame. I was so excited to spiral out this week with Django Gold. Django is a writer and a comedian. He is a staff writer on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He performs all over the place, and most importantly, he has a new stand-up special, an hour long, that just dropped on YouTube. I'm going to put the link to it in the show notes. It's called Bag of Tricks. I watched it recently. It is so funny. Give yourself a little treat and check it out. My little shame spiral for this week. Oy. I think that's the most Jewish I've ever been in the intro, and it is Yom Kippur today, so an easy fast to all who observe. I personally do not fast, which is actually another little shame spiral, but what I was going to share is that some of you may know the writer's strike is officially ending as of late last night today, and I have a pilot that I wrote a while ago, but I have been wanting to do this rewrite of it. That's a pretty like major haul reconstructive rewrite that I just know in my gut will make it so much stronger. And the whole strike, I was like, this is your time. Do it, do it, do it. Didn't do it, did not do it. And now I'm like, God damn it. Why didn't I do it? I should have done it. But I will say, last night I was on Twitter and I saw this other TV writer tweeted something like, right when the end of the strike was announced, she tweeted, like, that sound you hear is every writer opening final draft to work on the three pilots they said they would write during the strike. And that made me feel slightly less ashamed and a lot less alone. So that was nice. So that's all that I have today. I can't wait for you to listen to this episode. So without further ado, let's start spiraling with Django Gold.
Shame burning in my brain, always in a frame, and I've only myself to blame. Shame, wishing I could forget my name and crawl back up from where I came. I'm going down the spiral once again, the shame spiral.
I am cautiously optimistic because I can tell that you have an empathetic approach and you're not going to be punitive. You're not going to be taken aback. I can tell that you and I are going to kind of manage this minefield together, and it's not going to be like, this is not like a gotcha podcast where the moral of the story is my guest is the worst human being ever to pollute this earth. I think we're going to get through this together.
All right. I'm so happy that you feel that way. Now I have to ask you, like, is this just a gut assessment that you're making, or have you listened to episodes that has brought you to this conclusion?
Gut assessment. And I know that you would not have gone far if you were just fucking nailing everyone who came on your podcasts. Like, if this was just like a total sting operation where you just like had like witnesses testifying against the guest and it turned into like a big kangaroo court thing. And then you publish clips on social media of this like now pariah.
Oh, you know, shit.
Concealing their face. Yeah, what I think if, that'd be it.
Oh my God. If that was my agenda to sort of get people canceled via this
Absolutely.
Faux, like, we're going to talk about shame and it's going to be healing. And then I'm just like, got you, motherfucker. You
gotcha,
sick little
yeah.
fuck.
Yeah. Fell for the oldest trick in the book. Oh, stole some pennies from your grandmother's purse, did you? I thought you'd get off easy.
That is too funny. I mean, the thing that you just assessed, which made you feel good that you can tell I'm not, is that thing like your worst nightmare of what this would be?
Yeah, that's like the real like Alice in Wonderland, like court of public opinion type ending that I would, yeah, I think I and most people fear my horrible acts being dragged out into the light without sympathy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, I mean, what's your relationship like with shame and shame spiraling in general?
I think it's pretty closely tied in to anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that you start with like a little kernel of an emotion and you keep dwelling on it. and creating little like offshoots of it and offshoots of offshoots. And you think about it so often that it starts to become like a physical issue for you. And in that sense, it's similar. Like if I'm anxious about something, it usually has some kind of shame component. Like it's not just me being internally anxious. It's anxious because what if other people find out? Mm-hmm. What if they see me for what I am? Like that. So they're kind of like one and the same in a way.
Yeah. What if I'm exposed? Mm-hmm. And that fear of like, what if they see me for I am? Like, is a lot of your anxiety centered around that? Like, I'm secretly this horrible person and I got to make sure people don't find out.
It might be. I think I'm usually pretty accepting of my own flaws, but I guess it's just kind of like this persecution complex where it's like, oh, I feel like no one else will be. They will view me in the worst possible light, or maybe I'm a little forgiving, maybe too forgiving, to be honest, of my own deficiencies.
Mm. Why too forgiving?
I don't know. Sometimes I think I've done bad things. I shouldn't be let off easy. You know,
you deserve a little more persecution.
I think we all deserve a little persecution. It's a balance, of course. I don't think we should be constantly like whipped in the streets at all times. But yeah, I think some people could use a little more shame. I think
that's true. I think it's like there are things that we can all do that we're all capable of doing that sometimes it's like appropriate to feel ashamed when you're
absolutely
it's behaving a badly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the times what people crucify themselves for me, for sure, it's often something I do not deserve crucifixion mm-hmm. for. I mean, that's why it's really striking to me to hear you say that you're kind of easy-ish on yourself around your own flaws. I aspire to that. Have you always been that way? Like not so harsh on yourself?
No, I think back in like my halcyon days of anxiety when I was like constantly freaking out. This is like, you know, early 20s to late 20s, I guess. I was like way more anxious of a person. In that sense, I would always be really, you know, giving no forgiveness to myself about anything I'd done wrong. Mm-hmm. I think as I've gotten older and as I fucked up more times and realize it's just kind of an inevitable part of life, I become a little more forgiving about it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like back when you don't have as many examples of having fucked up, each one is more potent and horrible. But after it happens enough times, you realize, oh, I just kind of made a mistake and it happens to everyone. And that world did not end. Based on that, your fear of it goes down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Which is probably why old people seem not to really give a shit about social conventions. That's why you'll see like an old guy in a men's bathroom is like dropping his pants to his ankles to urinate because, you know, what anxiety is left in him?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the passage of time, like I feel like existentially, sometimes I think about when I smoked cigarettes in my 20s. And it was until I was 25, I smoked without the slightest concern around what it was doing to my body. I was just like, who the fuck cares? Like, it is so far away. And that's the thing that you lose as you get older. That's one of the things. And that's hard in some ways, but it's also, I can totally relate to what you're saying about the way that it diminishes the, the closer you get to death, just the more you can have perspective, I guess, about what really fucking matters. And you have so much more data.
Yeah. Yeah, it is about data. It's really about insufficient data in the beginning. And once you have like, you know, regress to mean a little bit, you get your heads a little more straight, I guess.
Yeah. For you, the anxiety kind of titrating down since your 20s, is that mostly because of like just the wisdom and perspective of aging, or did you also like go on SSRIs like I did, or
there, anything I wouldn't else? Say there's been much wisdom. it's mostly just like acceptance of my flaws, which I guess is a kind of wisdom. But no, I haven't been on any medication. I was briefly taking what's that, St. John's Wort?
Yeah.
But I found it wasn't really having much of an effect on me. I guess I kind of I expected too much of it. I thought it'd be like some amazing like endorphin boost and I'd be like, ah, ha, 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 life is grand. But it had like virtually no noticeable effect on me. So I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't need whatever's in this magic pill.
I'm kind of a sucker for Western medicine. I'm like, you can't expect much of anything you buy at the health food store. Like,
yeah, too healthy.
Yeah.
Especially that bullshit like fake fruit or not fake, real fruit leather. Nah.
Oh,
that's not going to help you out.
Like hippie fruit roll-ups? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I don't need that shit in my life. If I'm going to eat a fruit roll-up, I want it to be like this meaningless, zero nutrition, zero fiber, like, you know, factory monstrosity with, like, you know, a cut out of a dog cut into it.
Yeah. You want to, if you're going to eat a fruit roll-up, you want it to taste like the plastic it's wrapped in. Like,
that. Exactly.
That's what you're going for.
It should have no taste that's recognizable in nature.
Yeah. This might be too much of a question, but because you've mentioned it a couple of times about like your flaws and accepting your flaws, what do you consider like your core flaws to be?
Core flaws, I'd say indecision is one of them. A lack of patience. Often whenever I'm doing something I don't want to be doing, I'm like freaking out, like waiting in line for a grocery store, like 7 minutes is like a nightmare. It's like, let's go. And that's like a really silly, like immature. It's like what a child feels. It's a child wants everything they want all the time. And I feel like I do that a lot. And I also just say just general, like a lack of like what I would consider top tier social skills. I'm still kind of on like the intro tier, learner's permit level of like interacting with people.
How so? How do you see yourself as falling short socially?
I'm just very bad at small talk. I'm very bad at just like fitting in like a normal conversation. I feel like I often like creep people out or like weird them out. Like, you know, I have a tendency just not to talk, which I think people don't like in a social situation. Mm-hmm. I very rarely feel like compelled to fill the silence. Mm-hmm. I think people don't like that. And also it's like, I'll like ask like weird, dumb questions or say things that maybe are not within the boundaries of what was expected, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Never been a particularly good party guest.
I relate to all of that. I hate small talk. I'm not surprised to hear you say all of that because like when you first brought up the social stuff, I was like, I feel like we're already having such an easy conversation. But part of why this is the kind of podcast I do is because my desire is to like start talking to someone I just met and immediately have this kind of conversation. Like that's where I feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But if you're like asking me how's work and how's my kids, I'm just like, oh my God.
That's when you start freaking out. Yeah. It is interesting. Like once like the barriers come down, it always becomes pretty easy because the conversation becomes very human very quickly, you know, as opposed to asking like meaningless questions about like what TV shows you're watching. That you're just like, I think I feel cognizant of trying to fill the space in a way that doesn't really feel like fun. So that's I think where I start falling short.
Totally. And I also feel like there's this way where I'm like, I'm so not interested. Like I have no energy around those kinds of questions. So then I just feel very like, I would just rather be home alone doing my own thing than having this conversation.
Yeah.
And I think I feel a little bit, because it's not, it doesn't feel like I'm engaging with another human or like getting anything in terms of like understanding who they are. And you know, that's okay. This is very nerdy, but you know that Sartre, like the way that Sartre talks about nausea. Do you know that concept?
I've actually never read anything by him.
Okay. So. I just want you to know I'm not this pretentious. Like I've never once brought up like a philosopher on my podcast. I
read books.
But the reason it just came to my mind is because I love the way he writes about this, because it's kind of like the existential agony of like feeling not known and like you're not knowing someone else, like that isolation socially.
Right.
And like, that's kind of what I feel.
It's also bad to be known. Like that's also really embarrassing.
I know.
Like there has to be some kind of middle ground where I just like don't exist.
I know.
Only then can I be at peace.
Ugh, I really get that. I think about that. I just want to be a mist and then I would be free. Just dead, I guess, basically.
It's also difficult as a performer because you're just like putting yourself out there so often.
Yeah.
And like it's insane to have chosen this like type of lifestyle. It's like completely, I don't know about you, but for me, it's like completely counterintuitive to who I actually am. So I'm like forcing myself in like this weird shaped hole or peg or whatever, square peg, whatever, that like I do not naturally belong in, but I still do it for some kind of perverse reason.
Yeah. Like in terms of like the need to like chatty chat and network and be out in social settings and fun, that kind of part of it.
Exactly.
That's a hard part. Yeah. It's like when you're doing your jokes, it's like, it's highly controlled and, you know, it's like you are prepared and you know what you're going to do. And stand up is so like, you can count on you, you know, but all that other stuff. Yeah. It's hard and it's anxiety provoking.
Yeah.
Why do you think that you, like, do you have an assessment about why you got into comedy, especially because of that dissonance?
I honestly just started because, so I used to be like more of a musician. And I would like, when I was living in Boston, I would play like guitar, like the little like open mic night near my house, play like acoustic guitar songs. And at that open mic, there were all these comedians coming in and doing like their 5 minutes as like their performance, you know?
Yeah.
And I saw that after a few weeks, I was like, oh, I could do this. It seems like a fun thing to do. So I started writing down jokes and I did it and I enjoyed it. And from then on, it somehow just kind of, it really kind of took off. Not like in terms of like my ability at it, but I could just kind of tell from the get-go, like, oh, this is something that's like kind of important to me. It's something I'm like pretty good at. Like it's like, I've been playing music for like 10 years at that point, and I was like way better at comedy like from the get-go than I was at music after 10 years of doing it. So it was like pretty clear that like it was like something I was more inclined to be doing, you know?
Yeah. It's so wild how that happens. Like when you think that you're supposed to go on a certain path and it's really hard, and then all of a sudden you get on this other one and it's really unexpected, but just like everything is kind of easy and like flowing because it's right.
It also makes me wonder what paths I'm not taking that I would just like be like perfectly suited for. Like I could be the world's like greatest, you know, architect, but I'd never once took even the first step at it. So we'll never know, you know?
I know.
And there's also a bunch of things I'll probably be very shitty at that I'll never try. So it all comes out in the wash.
I'm very existential too, like thinking about all the, every choice, meaning that you're not choosing like 1,000 other things and you'll never know.
Well, we could run the simulation a few thousand times.
Yeah. All right. So let's do a little bit of a pivot. We're going to play the shame game. So yes. I'm going to present to you two scenarios and want you to then consider which one would be more likely to evoke a bigger, more debilitating shame spiral. And then we can talk a little bit about why.
All right.
Okay. So these are pretty bad. They're always bad. I don't know. I always like feel guilt when I'm about to present these to everyone. Well,
it wouldn't be fun if it was just like too lame. Like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, you got to make them bad. That makes sense.
It's so funny too, because when I started this podcast a year ago, they were very like, would you rather clog the toilet? Or like it was, I started kind of at a moderately shameful place and they've just gotten darker and darker as I've gone on.
Good.
Okay. So that being said, here's the first one. So a very, very, very good old friend of yours, let's say from like college or high school, just like picture one of your best friends in the world. And let's say he is in the comedy community as well. And he is, which is a shock to you and everyone, accused of some kind of Me Too situation. And you are so shocked by this. Like he is the last person you would ever expect this from. And you reach out to him and you're like, what the fuck? And he's like, listen, Django, like, I know how this sounds. I did not do this. Like, you know me, you have to trust me. Like, this is not who the fuck I am. And you're really torn up about it, but you're like, I have to believe this woman here. Like, I'm not going to be someone who's like, I'm going to stand up for my friend, because most people would tend to lie in this situation when accused, back up against the wall. But it's really hard for you. Like you don't really feel like it could be true, but you think about it a lot, you make that choice. And, you know, it blows up online. Like you kind of have to make a statement that's just like, I stand with this woman who, let's say she's also in comedy. And it's, you know, it's really brutal for your friend. It's brutal for you. It's brutal for everyone. And then a month or two later, this woman who had accused your friend comes out and is like, I lied. Like, mm-hmm. I know this is terrible. I'm setting the movement back, but I'm going through bad. I'm in a bad place in my life and I should not have lied, but I lied. And it's very clear that she's telling the truth. And you go back to your friend whose career is kind of like pretty fucked up now. Like, let's say his reps dropped him, like all the things. And he's been through hell around this. And you're like, dude, I can't apologize enough. Like, I hope you can understand why I felt like I had to just believe this woman. And he's just like, dude, I can't, like, this is going to take me for, I don't know that our friendship can ever be the same, you know? And sure. then you just have to sit with that. Okay. So that's scenario.
That's the first scenario. And to clarify, when you first started this project, it was like, oh, I shit too much and the toilet has too much of my shit in it. And now it sees very relevant, modern examples. Okay, good to know how far this bit has come.
You
okay.
should have come on right. a year ago. I mean,
yeah, like, that was a golden age of shame spiral.
I've just progressively been like, you're all going to see how unhinged I truly am. Okay, here's right. the second one. All right. So you are, I don't know, you're doing a show and one of your comedy idols is on the lineup with you. You've never met them before. You've never shared the lineup with them. And like whoever pops to your mind right now, like the truly like iconic for you, very fancy, just very important to you. Like let's say when you were starting out, they were huge for you in terms of inspiration and whatever. And it's so funny that this is kind of about social awkwardness because of what you shared earlier, but I had pre-written it. I'm not trying to like, gotcha, but great. So, you try to be chill, but you just are too excited and you can't like, and you're just kind of like trying to talk to him and not be weird. But then because you're trying to not be weird, you are extra weird. And, you can tell that maybe he's like, he or she or they or whatever are kind of like overwhelmed by your energy because there's a lot going on for you. And you're like, oh man, I'm being off-putting, but you're hanging in there. And then at one point your new special kind of comes up and you're like chatting about it a little bit. Yeah. You're telling them about it and they say something nice, like, oh yeah, maybe I'll check it out, whatever. And you're like, okay. And then that's it. The night ends and then you go home that night and you're like, I'm just gonna, like, you know, it's a bad idea, but you're like, I'm just gonna like DM them on Instagram, like the link to my special. Like they said they wanted to see it. I'm gonna send it my, you know, everyone would tell me that there's sure. nothing wrong with trying to like get your work out there. So you do it. And then you say like, I'm sorry, I was weird. Like, you're just really important to me. Just the spiral is going and going and going. Yep. And then the next day or a couple days later, you haven't heard from them. And you're like, let me just go see if they've read it, you know, on Instagram. Maybe they have that little thing on. And they have blocked you. And you just have to sit with that.
Sure.
So those are the two.
Those are the two. And so which, I'm supposed to choose which one would be worse?
Which one would just, do you think you would, like what, regardless of which one might be like objectively worse, you know, in quotes, like which one would send you on a worse shame spiral?
100% the first one.
Okay. I knew, you know, I couldn't.
The first one is so much worse in every way.
I'm cursing myself right now because I knew that the second one is bad, but it's so relative.
Second one's bad in a vacuum. It's definitely bad. But like, it's not even come close.
You know what? The first one. No, I knew I should have come up with something to match.
It's hard. You're doing these every week.
Oh, damn. I get it. It's hard. All right. So that was too easy. But that being said,
we could talk about,
tell me about what would come up for you with the first one and like what your spiral would look like.
Well, the first one, like every single aspect of it is uncomfortable. You have the accusation, which is uncomfortable. You have your relationship with the friend, which is uncomfortable. You have the The feelings and the trauma of the woman, which is uncomfortable. And then it all gets flipped on its head, a month later. So you're taking all these things both ways. Like, it's like an insane, fucking perfect storm of anxiety. I think the first one is just it's really important to try to do the right thing. And sometimes you try to do the right thing and it fucks you over. So there's no real way around that in certain situations, but God, that I can't even imagine, especially in this situation, thinking about the guilt I would feel for having just not been with my friend when he needed me in a situation where he was entirely in the right, or at least in this scenario, he is. God knows what kind of gray areas there may be in the real world. That being said, yeah, I think that one would really, really be a tough one for me.
Would you just be kind of beating yourself up about how you hadn't been there for him? Would that be the focal point of it, of the shame?
I think that would also just be the, for lack of a better term, ickiness of having to wade into this very uncomfortable, harmful situation. And just anytime you're dealing with that, it's you're just, tiptoeing through the tulips on it. It's very carefully, And it's just one of those things, it's just not your natural, it's no one's natural state to be involving themselves in something that's that amplified, that important, serious as that. So it must, I can't even imagine how much nervousness would be produced by that,
Yeah. It would be horrible.
Well, thank God it's just a scenario.
Thank God. And out of curiosity, what would happen for you around that second scenario?
I would just feel very bad and feel very embarrassed, but you take your lumps in this business.
Okay. So would it not hit you too hard? Would you not obsess over it?
I would obsess over it maybe a little bit, but nowhere near the first one.
Oh, yeah,
I would I think the second one would be more of a live and learn type situation. The first one would be more of a life destroying, atom bomb type situation. So when I have the option, I prefer to live and learn if possible.
Oh man. I don't know what in God's name made me think those two scenarios were any sort of match for each other. I'm spiraling about it.
I think what you did, you picked the first one, which is a fucking grade A fucking knockout punch. And then it's really hard to meet up with that one. I can't I think if you had the second one, it probably would have been easier to go back down to that level.
Totally.
But unfortunately, you had to aspire way too high with that first one. It's kind of hard to.
Yeah.
Density.
This is a live and learn moment for me. Yeah. It was kind of would you rather hurt your girlfriend's feelings or kill them? Worse? What do you think?
I'm just glad I got a clear cut one that was just so easy to answer. I feel like I'm 1-0 on the shame spiral games. And none of your listeners will disagree. They'll all be 100% on board. So I win.
They will be like, I'm going to get some comments. The shame game. You did. You won the shame game. You did.
Yeah.
All right. So away from the hypothetical, I asked you to bring one story of something that actually happened to you that brought up a lot of shame. Do you have one in mind?
My friend TJ Miller was accused of sexual. No.
Oh my God. I was so with you with that. I really thought that's what was going to happen right now.
I would not voluntarily bring that up.
That literally pushed me back into my seat.
Yes, okay. I apologize. Two can play the shame game.
I deserve that. I deserved that one. Yeah,
that's right. Now the puppet master has become the puppet.
Yes.
Mine is a sorry, what were you going to say?
So you are not friends with TJ Miller in reality.
No, I'm not friends with TJ Miller.
I'm just clarifying that right now.
Oh, yeah. To all your listeners, I have no alliance or even particular like of TJ Miller.
Okay.
So please don't be lumping in me with it.
Okay.
Doofus.
This was out of care for you that I just made sure that
we
named that. Yeah. Now go on.
Okay. So this one is a little more mundane than any of the examples you have. It's more of a faux pas type thing. But this happened about a year ago, 2 years ago, something like that. I was at a bagel place. I was buying my bagel, and the cost of the bagel was let's say $4.06 or something. And I give the cashier a $5 bill, and she's starting to divvy out 94 cents or whatever is my change. And my intention was just, you know, put my change in the tip jar. So what I do is like, oh no, I'll make it easier. And I put my hand in the tip jar, take out 6 cents from that and give it to her with the idea that now she could give me just back a clean dollar, which I could then drop into the tip jar. And she did not seem to be on board with this. She seemed like really shocked that I put my hand in the tip jar. She was clearly uncomfortable about it. And she's like, oh, that's interesting. And then like, oh, well, I was going to, and then like, she's kind of like looked away from me. And I was like, well, that kind of fucked that one up. And I was kind of like, I think about it every so often, and especially in the weeks that follow, like, was that insane to put my hand in the tip jar? Was I being more of like, just kind of like a little too casual about it? Or was that like the right amount of casual? And was she overreacting? What do you think, Ellie?
I think that it makes sense to me. And I can imagine a world where she doesn't know what's happening in your mind. So I could see the initial assessment being like, is this guy tipping, like paying me in my own tips without immediately computing what you were actually doing?
Yes.
I get that. It's like that is really kind of embarrassing though. What?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where, like, oh, I don't know if I can come back here for a few months. Hopefully the woman will forget me or move to a different job, you know?
Wait, so what did you do? Did you try to explain? Like, did you get into, like, let me break this down?
There were people behind me in line. There was no time to recover from this. It was just like, fuck up and move on.
Oh, you know? No. That's really so much worse.
Oh, yeah. If I'd had time to explain, I would have smooth talked to it. It would have been perfect, you know? But no, it was one of those things where, like, oh, I made a mistake and now bye. You know, you don't get a second chance at a first impression.
Oh my God. See, I would not, yeah. I'm impressed because I would not be able to stop myself from trying to explain. Like the thought of them thinking that I was stealing money from the tip jar to pay for my coffee would destroy me. But you were like, no, there's people behind. I gotta go.
I mean, it's one of those situations, and this might be kind of like the wisdom of age or whatever, is that like sometimes you realize, oh, I fucked up. That's it. Got to go. Like there's no real way of fixing it. And the best thing to do is extract yourself as quickly as you can, especially when you live in New York City. We're like, well, I'll probably never see anyone in this room ever again. So, yeah.
What was the look that she gave you? Like what were you receiving in that moment?
Honestly, it was like the first one looked like kind of like fear. Like, what is this fucking crazy person doing? And that's like where the guilt and the shame comes from. It's like, oh God, am I like freaking out this lady? Am I freaking out? You know, is this like totally out of line? Have I totally broken the social contract in this bagel place? Mm-hmm. You know, so she did not seem to be a happy camper.
Did it bring up something? I mean, this is maybe deeper than it was, but I mean, with that fear piece, did it bring up something for you about like being like a scary man, like that kind of thing?
Yeah. I don't know if there was much of like a gender aspect to it. I think it was more just like kind of like a line of pride had been crossed. Like it'd be like the equivalent of like, I don't know, like going through someone's medicine cabinet or something, just like kind of like intruding in a way I should not have been intruding.
Yeah. Like you broke the social contract. You were outside of the norms. Yeah.
Yeah. People, money goes in the tip jar, does not come out, and certainly never by the customer's hand. I guess what the problem is I was treating it like more of like a take a penny, leave a penny tree, which it certainly is not, you know? So I accept responsibility. I fucked up.
I mean, but also you didn't. Like, you were not taking money. You were making change.
Right. But it's one of the situations that we come across so often in life where it's like, oh, I had good intentions. What a good person I am with my good intentions. But you can still fuck up and hurt people with good intentions.
That's true. But I think it's a stretch to say that you hurt someone in that.
No, I would say this is a relatively mild crime. It's not.
Oh man, but it sounds like that sort of schema of like I've broken a social norm. I've been a weirdo. That kind of thing. Like part of why you might have taken it so hard is because that is situated in you as like a thing that is activating. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Is that like from since you were a kid? Like, have you had a lot of experiences where you felt like, oh fuck, I'm not doing this correctly?
I don't know. I feel like as a kid, I was a little more carefree. I think anxiety is something and Gerald kind of like started developing it in like my late teenage years. Mm-hmm. I think I was a little like cloistered off from the world in a way that like I wasn't really like, I wasn't aware of like, you know, being socially awkward until like much later in life, I would say.
Oh, wow. How were you spared from that? Like in high school and middle school and stuff?
I don't know. It's a good question. Like I'm thinking back on it. I just don't ever really like, I think I'm sure I did not have zero anxiety and zero shame, but I just don't feel it being as intense as it was like as an adult. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is. I know people say like their high school years are the really awkward years, and I'm sure they were for me as well, but like, I just don't remember it being particularly unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Things got much harder for you as like a late teen, early 20s.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Were you in music school?
No. I went to a pretty square college called Boston College.
Oh my God. I went to BU.
Oh, our cursed rivals. Boo. Your hockey team is worse than my hockey team.
I hated BU, so you can shit on it all you want.
Did you live in those towers on Comm Ave?
I fucking did only my freshman year, and then I lived in Alston the rest of the time. Yeah, where did you live on campus or off?
I did live on campus mostly, but after I graduated, I lived on Highgate Street in Alston, which is like one street over from Harvard Ave.
Okay. Wow. What years were you there?
I lived in Boston post-graduating from like 07 to 09, baby.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. I was kind of close to Silhouette Lounge, which I guess everyone is because Alston's pretty small.
I know exactly. Before I quit drinking, I used to go to Silhouette Lounge frequently.
Free popcorn, darts.
That's right. Boston was not my city. That was a weird fit for me. I don't know why I went there.
I didn't really enjoy it either myself. I don't really have much like sentimentality about it either. I don't like look back on it with much fondness.
Me neither.
Sorry, Boston.
Man. The only thing that was, well, that's not true. There were some positive things, but I worked at JP Licks on Newberry Street.
Oh yeah. That place rocks.
That was my college job. And that was a good fucking job. It was great. The ice cream. We got to play good music. Newberry Street was fun. That was like one good thing.
You want to hear a funny JP Licks story?
Oh yeah.
So if you might recall, on Red Sox opening day, JP Licks would often have a promotion where they would give $1 ice cream cones. Mm-hmm. So one year, whenever this happened, opening day, I was working in the Prudential Center in like an office, my office job there. And for lunch one day, I went to JP Licks and I just ate three ice cream cones for a total of $3. My original plan was I'll just get one ice cream cone. Well, that was pretty good. I'll get a second one. Next thing you know, I just consumed three separate ice cream cones on my lunch break. And so that's my lunch. I go back into the office. I'm at my computer for a while, working, whatever. And then eventually it's time to go to the bathroom. And I go to the bathroom. And at this time, I had like a pretty big beard, like thicker than it is now. And I look at myself in the mirror and I just have like ice cream like all over my face.
Oh my God. And you'd been sitting at your desk in the Prudential Center for like an hour.
Yeah, just like hilarious. Just like going through like security on the bottom floor, like key card and everything, was just like ice cream all over me. Like a fucking messy child.
Oh my God. Now, were you able to laugh at that at the time, or did you spiral about that?
This was not a job I gave a shit about. So it was perfectly fine by me. But yeah, just like that whole story just like is just like a certain era of my life where I just had like no sense of decorum, just eating ice cream for lunch and all this shit.
I totally understand. We used to get a free pint with every shift.
Oh, every shift. Oh my God. You must have been ice cream rich.
I was so ice cream rich, and I was a huge stoner, and so were all my roommates. So we were just flush with ice cream. And
that's
we were
great.
I'm very curious, and then we can move on from this because I don't know if it'll be interesting to anyone but me and maybe you, but what were the three flavors that you selected back to back?
I think it was all one, and it's what I almost always get there, which is the Oreo cake batter, which has like yellow like cake batter crumbles in it. That was
sweet cream.
It's very sweet. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I just went back to back to back to that.
Wow, the same flavor. You were just like, I can't. I need. I'm not satiated.
I'm a creature of habit.
you just kind of know what you like and you're happy to kind of repeat it.
I also, there's very few things that are more disappointing than ordering the wrong thing at a restaurant and not liking it.
Yeah.
So based on that, I find myself sometimes scared to venture out of my comfort zone.
I took a big ice cream swing yesterday, which I was very nervous about for that same reason. Because I was like, this is such a nice little treat. I like took my two kids to get ice cream and it was like 7 p.m. on a Wednesday. I was like, this is so fun. And I knew I would be disappointed. Like, it would be so crushing to have an unsatisfying ice cream cone. Mm-hmm. And I usually get Oreo. Like, I just like a cookies and cream. That's my favorite.
Great standby. Yeah.
But their Oreo didn't look right. And so I got strawberry and I was impulse buy. And I was like, this is probably not going to do it. But then it was so good. And I was really,
there you go.
It was positive experience. Sometimes taking risks is good.
where'd you get ice cream?
I live in Windsor Terrace. We were, you're in New York, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in Manhattan.
Oh, you're in Manhattan. So it was in like Kensington, Flatbush kind of area.
Yeah, it's just a lesson to be learned there.
Yeah. Yep.
Getting out of your comfort zone is fine when it comes to ice cream.
When it comes to ice cream, you know, it's very low stakes. Yeah. So let me ask you this. You've been working in comedy for a long time. Do you have any like comedy shame moments that really stand out to you that kind of haunt you to this day?
I mean, yeah. Anytime I bomb on stage as a stand-up is pretty bad. There have been times when I've like invited like a date to come see me perform and it has not gone well. So that's always pretty bad because you're failing in two respects at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anything like that is pretty bad. And I actually once got pretty much booed off stage at Littlefield like 4 years ago. There were some people in the crowd that heckling me. They did not like my material for reasons I could get into if I want. We'll see. But anyway, it basically like ended with me just like storming off the stage because I was so mad. And this is all my birthday, more or less. So that's an experience that probably stayed with me for the rest of my life. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I should have used that as my anecdote. What was I doing talking about this fucking tip jar thing?
Wait. Well, you know, we tend to avoid the things that are the most excruciating.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, can you share more details about that Littlefield story?
Sure. Basically, I was on a show there. I won't say the name of the show, but it's a good show. Packed crowd, and I went up first, which is called taking the bullet spot in stand up. And like within 2 minutes of my set, some people in the crowd did not like my material. I think they were like offended by it, or they're purporting to be offended by it, but they started complaining about it. And then this was a point in my career where I wasn't really very good at responding to hecklers or people interrupting. So at this point in my life, my philosophy was just like charge on through it. And that was a mistake because these people talked and like loudly interrupted me like the entire show. And eventually got to like my very last joke. The set had been like a total nightmare. And I was like 20 words away from ending my last joke. And then they interrupted me again. I was like, you know what? If anyone wants to know the punchline of this, come to me after the show. I'll talk about that. And I just walked off stage. It was a disaster. I was the first act on the show. So like that. I think that may have set a pretty poor tone for the rest of the evening.
Oh God.
Yeah. It was bad.
And were the heckles really specific, like about how they were offended, or were they just,
yes. I don't remember exactly the wording of it, of what they were complaining, like what their complaints were, but they were definitely like offended at what I was saying, not really giving me much of the benefit of the doubt. Cause you know, I'm not sure if you've seen my stand-up, but I will often like kind of like do like a character where I'm saying something crazy or out of line, kind of to reveal how dumb it is, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was doing a lot of that. I don't think they were going with me on that journey.
Oh man, that's so brutal.
It was a tough one. And again, this wasn't on my birthday.
And your birthday.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, you hadn't brought a date to this one.
No, I brought some friends and they were both there. And I was like, okay, so let's go get a drink, I guess. I don't know. And then we did our little post-mortem.
Yeah. I hate inviting friends to see me perform on the off chance that I bomb, because I want it to just disappear. Yeah.
you're playing with fire for sure. But then the benefits, you reap the benefits, which is if it goes well, then you know your friends got to see you. So
I know it's such
that part's great.
And it's like a metaphor for vulnerability in a way too, because it's like, if it goes badly, even though that's nightmarish that your friends witnessed it, then they're also there for you and you can go have a postmortem. You're not alone. But
I think I find that kind of sympathy even worse though. I would rather no one do that to me, to be honest.
Really? I mean, me too, but I feel like intellectually I can see how that's a good thing and that's like intimacy or whatever, but I don't like it either. I just want to be like, nobody talk to me. I'm going home. I'm going to crawl into a cave for a couple of days.
The cave life is definitely preferable. I agree.
Oh man, that's so brutal. That was like 4 years ago. Does it still come up in your body? Like when you're on a show at Littlefield?
Not in my body, but it does come up in conversation occasionally. Actually, like a year ago, I ran to a guy on the street. And for some reason, he brought that up, and I realized that guy was not at the show. So he heard about it from someone else, and now he knows it. Like, so that was like, oh, Christ, this is actually like an event that caused people to gossip about me, which is not a great feeling.
Oh, my God, that's such a nightmare.
Yeah.
What else do I want to ask you? Okay, if you were to picture the experience of shame and shame spiraling as a sort of animal or creature or figure of some kind in the way that you experience it, what comes to your mind just instinctually?
Cockroach skittering away when the light turns on.
Oh, just yeah.
Wanting to be away at all costs.
That's the shame.
That's the shame. The shame and the desire to hide.
The desire to hide, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you don't want to be perceived being the cockroach.
What would you say your totem is?
It kind of changes. It's often, I mean, I'll tell you what I usually tell people when they ask me, which is that it's kind of like a really sort of disgusting goblin sort of figure, you know.
That's not an animal.
Yeah, it kind of is. It's a mythical creature.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You know, very very golem like kind of.
Sure. Yeah, golem's a good example. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay, a couple more things. So you have a special that just came out. It's called Bag of Tricks.
Bag of Tricks.
Bag of Tricks. Django Gold. I just watched it a few days ago. It's very funny.
Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, thanks for watching it. That's awesome.
Yeah, totally. Nice enjoyed it so much. Is there anything you want to tell folks about it? Besides, like, go watch it, which you definitely should.
Go watch it, which you definitely should. It's my first special after like 12 years of doing this. So it's basically like everything I believe and think about how comedy should be done, about who I am as a performer, about the types of jokes I want to do, that all went into the special. And I think oftentimes you have like these big ambitions about how an artistic work you're making, how you want it to come out, and it often pales in comparison. This special Bag of Tricks is very rare for me because it actually came out pretty much exactly how I envisioned it, which almost never happens. So if you like it, then you like what I think of as art. And if you don't like it, I could not have given you any better, because this is who I am as a work. It's an artistic statement. I don't want to talk it up too much, but it's pretty great.
it's really good. It's really so solid and funny. That's Thank amazing you. That you feel that about it. Like that you're actually having that experience of like, this is me and I'm happy with it and I'm proud of it. It's hard to have that.
It all just kind of came together very well. And I didn't really compromise in terms of like what I was going to do and how I was going to present it. I just kind of came out on stage and did who I am as an act, and it somehow worked. The crowd was really into it. Both the tapings went well, and the editor and the post-production guys, everyone did a great job. So it just came out like really very great. I'm very proud of it.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I love that.
Yeah. And usually that's not how it works. Usually you have these grand plans, and next thing you know, you have like a bunch of fucking popsicle sticks stacked on top of each other. It's nothing that you anticipated.
You're like, will this do?
My beating heart.
And I mean, yeah, I feel like that's especially why I'm kind of moved to hear you talk about it that way, because for so many artists, for me personally, it's very hard for me to leave something I've done, even if it's something I worked that hard on or whatever, and be like, that was good enough. I feel good about it. Like, I am happy with it. Like, that is extremely elusive.
That's the nature of art. You know, you're never really satisfied with what you're doing. And also you keep evolving so that whenever you look back, something will not be up to your current standards. So you look at it with like a kind of, I don't want to say disgust, but you're just not as happy with it as you were at the time. So like it kind of diminishes naturally like that, you know?
Totally. Yeah, that's so great. So was there anything that we talked about today that I said or you said or anything that just, you know, was kind of in the ether that made you have a little meta shame spiral in the moment?
The most shame I was getting was when I was envisioning the Me Too scenario, and I was picturing the person in my head who it would have been. Not that this person would be more or less likely to be the person, but just the person that came to mind. And no, I will not be saying this person's name on your podcast, just for the record. But I was mostly just getting some kind of like vicarious shame just by visualizing the moment and visualizing what it would be like to be in that scenario. So it wasn't like, it wasn't shame based on anything you were saying. It was mostly just shame of like me kind of like going into like the, you know, the dream world of what that would be like and feeling that secondhand.
Projecting yourself into that scenario.
Exactly. Because, you know, I don't know if you get these like type of like, you know, what do you call them? Like something thoughts. What's the phrase where like it kind of like drags you along? I can't think of the phrase, but like, you'll get anxious and like a lot of these fake scenarios like kind of carry you away to further levels of anxiety.
Oh yeah.
I was getting like a little introductory version of that with that.
Yes. I am familiar with that. Just subjecting yourself needlessly to anxiety based on an imaginary situation all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Just pure self-torture.
Pure self-torture. It could be worse. Yeah. It could be worse. How do you feel right now as we're at the end of our conversation?
I feel pretty good. It was really nice to meet you. I was kind of impressed by how easily we hit it off and were able to just kind of talk openly about this stuff. It was really fun and pretty open and easy, you know?
Yeah. It was so nice to meet you.
No shame here. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Shame Spiral. You can follow the pod at Pod Shame Spiral on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the usual places. This episode was edited by myself and Sarah Gabrielli, and original music was by Shadwick Wild. Please keep listening and rate and review if you're feeling generous. I have so many exciting guests lined up for our season. Thank you again for joining us, and spiral on, but not too much, okay?